There are a number of ideas about how life began on Earth. One prevalent proposal is that a supreme deity created life. Any discussion of a theistic account of life and language must acknowledge that the origin of both is an important line in the sand for theists. One frequent theistic answer to the question of how DNA and subsequent forms of life evolved is the watchmaker theory. Watches were, at the time of this metaphor, the highest technology known. For many reasons, discussions of philosophers and theists often revolve around the most advanced technology of the day. In this case, watches are intricate, complicated, hierarchical in structure, and obviously designed. So, if someone found a watch on a distant planet, the presence of that watch would indicate that somewhere there was a designer who had a purpose in mind for it, designed it, and fabricated it. William Paley put it this way in his Natural Theology in 1802. "In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone, and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer I had before given, that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. There must have existed, at some time and at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed the watch for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch, exists in the works of nature, with the difference, on the side of nature, of being greater or more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation." Paley's argument for an artificer precedes the work of Wallace and Darwin on evolution by natural selection by more than half a century. There are modern theologians and theistic scientists who consider this argument sound, substituting a complex organ such as the eye in place of the watch. But philosopher David Hume pointed out three serious problems with the watch analogy. First, the materials of the watch are not found naturally. The watch is built from human-made materials. This makes the analogy artificial. As Hume said, it would make much more sense to use something composed exclusively of organic materials, such as a squash, instead of a watch, because one can observe that squashes come forth on their own. Hume's second objection is that one may not use experiential knowledge to infer a conclusion about non-experiential knowledge. If you understand what a watch is, you also know that the watch was created. One could even observe a watch being made. Yet no one could have any direct experience with the creation of the world. Thus, the conclusion that because a watch has a designer, the universe also does, is not only empirically unjustified, but also illogical. Finally, Hume remarked that even if a watch did show that every complicated thing, the universe in particular, has a designer, this lesson would still have nothing to say about the nature of that designer. Such reasoning thus, even if it had not been shown to be invalid, supports no known religion or idea of a deity above any other. Perhaps the most effective argument against the watchmaker analogy, however, comes from culture. No person can make a watch or its component materials by themselves. A watch is the output of a culture, not a designer. If the universe was designed, this design would have required a society, not a god, unless that god were far different than it is described in the major religions. More to the point, however, the theistic design argument for the universe fails because the science says so. There is a solid scientific foundation to evolutionary theory that is lacking in theistic accounts. Evolution is a well-established fact. Only the explanations of how evolution happens or looks, natural selection, genetic processes, and family trees, can be called theories. But evolution itself is not a theory. In order to understand the origin of language, the origin of life more generally must be considered in order to frame the discussion. And that requires evolution. The Earth is roughly 4.5 billion years old, and probably began as a whirling cloud, cooling and solidifying, its waters gradually ending their cycle of rain and evaporation, reducing the surface temperature of our red planet enough to accumulate in turbulent, lifeless, hot oceans inhospitable to all life, in the Precambrian period's Archean eon. But phosphates, sugars, nitrogen were about in the oceanic stew, and from these the first carbohydrates and other building blocks of life were formed. At least, that is one possible explanation. Another account offered by scientists is that replicating DNA wholly originated in space and was brought to Earth by a meteorite or asteroid. This proposal for the origin of DNA is known as panspermia. According to the proponents of this view, nucleotides are more easily formed in the cold and ice of comets. Our planet was like a giant ovum floating in space, fertilized by space dust, meteors, and asteroids, the spermatozoa of the universe, which brought DNA to us. There is even some convincing evidence for this view. Meteorites regularly enter Earth's atmosphere. Some of these might have brought DNA to Earth from another part of the universe or solar system. Or perhaps meteors brought not DNA, but nucleotides from other parts of space. Whatever happened, nucleotides eventually joined together in the seas. Later, membranes began to form around them. Within those membranes, nucleic acids, along with ribonucleic acid, RNA, and deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, formed. At some point, these acids took on the property responsible for all life, replication. From the formation of the Earth until molecular life began to form took roughly 500 million years. Within another 500 to 800 million years, life forms large enough to be visible as fossils were produced. From the beginning of this nucleotide soup, Earth transitioned to the Proterozoic early life period of the Precambrian. The foundation of life, DNA, again formed from sugars, phosphates, and nitrogen. Because of an understanding of DNA, it is known that a human and a dog are distinguished at the molecular level by the composition of their DNA and the ways in which their DNA is sequenced to form their genome. Genomes are thus the sum of the various DNA and RNA and their combinations. Fine-tuning a bit, canines and humans are not merely distinguished by the components of their DNA, but by the syntax of their DNA. The hierarchy of DNA and units relevant to it is chromosomes, carriers of DNA, then DNA plus histones, then genes, segments of DNA. If one considers the Earth from its beginning until today, 99.997% of the planet's history had passed before the Pleistocene, 2.8 million years ago, When Homo habilis, or Homo erectus, depending on classification, the first species of the genus Homo emerged. Species such as sapiens arose even later. The period in which the earliest hominins gave rise to modern humans began from the late Miocene, 23 to 5.3 million years ago, through the Pliocene, 5.3 to 2.8 million years ago, and the Pleistocene, up until the current age, the Holocene, 11,000 years ago. Humans enjoy a privilege unique among all other life forms that enables them to contemplate their origin. And yet, all human perspectives are culturally shaped. Therefore, along with superior mental powers, cultures not only guide humans' understanding of the world, but also define what is worth looking at. Culture constrains how humans justify their reasoning. Science emerges from and is shaped by the values of culture, different social roles, and the knowledge structures that have been sanctioned by society. That is, what knowledge is and how different components of our knowledge are related to one another. Culture is one reason that different scientists take different views on the fossil evidence. It is not merely disagreement about the facts, though that too is important. Richard Feynman was one of the first to notice that results of physics experiments tended to be closer to published expectations than one would have otherwise expected. This points to one cultural effect in science known as confirmation bias. Even though consideration is given only to science, there is no escaping from the shadow of cultural influences. Interpretations of much of the fossil record change regularly. My conclusions here are no different, although this difference makes them no better or worse than other conclusions until more data is brought to bear. The accumulated scientific record built by Homo sapiens through language and Western culture concludes that humans are primates, and that the roots of their genus are to be found in the origins of the primates. So, what are primates, and where did they come from? The primate order, of which Homo sapiens is one species, arose more than 56 million years ago. Because evolution is gradual and continuous, there are proto-primates that precede the proper primates. The earliest known proto-primate transitional fossil is Plesiotopes tricuspidans, which existed some 58 million years ago in North America. But the story of primate evolution begins in earnest with the first known true primate genus, the Teardina, which were the precursors of all other primates, including us. The Teardina, named after the Jesuit theologian and paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, were small creatures, similar in size to modern marmosets. As these creatures developed and found separate niches, they formed varieties and, eventually, new species. From the new species came new genera. Many primates break down into genera according to the shape or conditions of their noses. For example, the wet-nosed or strepsirrhine primates today are limited almost exclusively to the lemurs of Madagascar. Humans are counted among the haplorrhini, or dry-nosed monkeys. The haplorrhini in turn break down into the tarsiformes and simiaformes, simians, or anthropoids, from which humans come. There is further subdivision into catarrhines, long noses, and platyrrhines, flat or downward noses. All monkeys native to the New World have nostrils that point sidewards, while all Old World primates, including humans, have nostrils that point downwards. Figure 3 summarizes the classification of humans among other primates and can be found in the bonus PDF. Figure 3 shows the primate tree with humans as part of the infraorder Catarrhinae, as previously described. As well as being Catarrhines, humans are also, along with all monkeys and apes, simians. The Platyrrhines of the Americas evolved differently from their Old World relatives, producing no apes, only monkeys. No humans, therefore, evolved in the New World. All primates can climb trees, though I confess that I cannot climb as well as a woolly monkey. All humans possess, as primates, bodies designed, at least partially, for tree climbing. Some also stand out from other mammals for more important reasons than their climbing prowess. Humans have large brains, a reduced sense of smell, and stereoscopic, 3D, vision. All traits that have helped them become the rulers of a very real planet of the apes. Evolution is the great Procrustean bed of life, where species are stretched, chopped, and otherwise modified to fit their niche. As evolution brought the primates forth from the great mammalian surge that followed the end of the dinosaurs during the Cretaceous Paleogene, KPG, extinction event some 66 million years ago, it launched another in a long line of cognitive leaps. Eventually, this long mammalian advance produced the hominids. Most modern scientists use the term hominid, the singular form of the Latin word hominidae, men, to refer to all the great apes. The English form of the plural is hominids. There are a few who still prefer to use the word in its older sense, to refer not to all the great apes, but to the genus Homo. But most modern scholars reserve hominid to describe collectively the great apes and hominin, hominini, humans, and all of their direct ancestors, beginning from the time that chimps and humans split into separate branches of the primate tree. Using two terms, hominid and homo, does not increase the perceived complexity of human evolution. It simply helps to avoid ambiguity. By contrast, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection is much less complicated. Indeed, part of its attraction and elegance is its very simplicity. It consists of three postulates. First, the ability of a population to expand is infinite in principle, though the ability of an environment to support a population is always finite. Second, there is variation within every population. Therefore, no two organisms are exactly alike. Variation affects the ability of individuals to survive and multiply, as some produce more viable offspring in a given niche. Third, somehow parents are able to pass their variation along to their offspring. Together, these three postulates have come to be combined as descent by natural selection. Darwin noticed during his famous trip aboard the HMS Beagle that animals seemed adapted to fit their environment. And throughout his scientific career, he also noticed how different creatures, such as his famous Galapagos finches, adapt rapidly to even small changes in their environments. Ironically, while Darwin was proposing natural selection, a Czech monk, Gregor Mendel, was laying the foundations of genetic theory. Working with garden peas for 7 years, Mendel developed two important principles of genetic research. First was the principle of segregation, which is the idea that given traits are broken into two parts, known now as alleles, and only one of these parts passes from each parent to the shared offspring. Which allele is passed along is random. Second came the principle of independent assortment, By this principle, the pairs of alleles produced by the union of the parents' haploid cells form new combinations of genes that are not present in either the mother or the father. Though Mendel's work eventually gained dramatic acceptance, there were still problems that were overcome only with the advent of modern genetics. First, as Thomas Morgan showed in his now famous work on fruit fly mutations, genes are linked. That is, they work in tandem in many traits. This is contrary to Mendel's idea that each gene behaves independently, an idea that many geneticists had embraced prior to Morgan's work. Morgan's findings meant that the independent assortment of genes wasn't right, contra Mendel. Morgan also brought to his research original and long-term interests in cell structures. Through this work, it became clear that chromosomes were real entities in cells, and not merely hypothetical gene vehicles. Second, Mendel suggested that variation is always discrete, but in fact, it is usually continuous. If one mates a 6-foot-5-inch mother with a 5-foot-2-inch father, one will not get simply either a 5-foot-2-inch versus a 6-foot-5-inch child, but any height between those, at minimum, among other possibilities. In other words, many, in fact, most, traits blend. This is not captured in the simple interpretation of independent assortment from Mendel's work on peas, in which all traits he worked on were discrete and, for the purposes of his research, unrelated. Another crucial fact about evolution is that the targets of natural selection are phenotypes, externally visible physical and behavioral attributes resulting from genes and environment, not genotypes, the genetic information that is partially responsible for the phenotype. Thus, natural selection operates on, selects for survival, creatures based on their behavior and overall physical properties. Genes underlie these properties and behaviors, but the phenotype is more than genes. It is partially produced by histones, environment, and culture. The histones control the timing of the unfolding of genetic information and thus how the genes produce the phenotype. When non-biologists think of evolution, they often conjure up ideas of new species. But, though that is one byproduct of evolution, looking only at speciation as evidence is misleading. If a creation scientist says that creatures can't transform into others, and that evolution must therefore be false, what they are actually disputing is macroevolution, evolution on a grand scale. However, macroevolution is not the only form of evolution. In fact, macroevolution is usually the accumulation of smaller evolutionary changes, perhaps as small as the mutation of a single allele, known as microevolution. While microevolution is, by definition, less discernible, especially to observers with short human lifespans, it is where the real action takes place. As a result, if one can explain the small changes, the larger changes will follow, by and large. Evolutionary scientists seek to understand biological change over time, evolution, in all of its forms. Macro and micro evolution are simply points along a vast continuum of modification by natural selection. One of the ways in which micro and macro evolution are stimulated is via mutation. Many mutations are neutral. Other mutations are fatal. But some mutations provide a survival advantage to their host organism. A change favored by natural selection in a particular environment is advantageous if the mutated creature produces more viable offspring than creatures lacking the mutation. Neutral mutations are important for evolutionary theory, even though they are, by definition, neither harmful nor helpful to the survival of their host. As Linus Pauling, the only person in history to win two unshared Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry and one for peace, and Emil Zuckerkandl, a pioneer in genetic dating, proposed in 1962, neutral changes occur at a constant rate over time. This constancy works like a molecular clock, one that can help determine when two related species diverged. Today, it has become a vital tool in understanding evolutionary differences among creatures, even though they are not themselves responsible for those differences. Mutations favored by natural selection, however, are not the only way that evolution works. For anything as complicated as the whole of life on Earth, it should not be surprising to learn that no one concept explains it all. There are other sources of micro and macro evolution than natural selection. One of these is known as genetic drift. Technically, in genetic drift, there is a reduction in a population's genetic diversity. Imagine that the population of all humans is 1,000 individuals from 100 families. Now assume that the genes that produce photopigments in 5 families from this 1,000, say 50 individuals, are deficient. These individuals are colorblind. Next, imagine that these colorblind individuals come to be shunned by the majority as undesirable for some cultural reason, and that all 50 of them therefore decide to move elsewhere. Finally, suppose that the original population, the non-colorblind individuals, are wiped out by disease or natural disaster after the departure of the colorblind individuals. The colorblind people are unaffected. This improbable but possible chain of events will result in a state where the only genes left among the species are the genes that produce colorblindness. The colorblind community may grow over time, producing many offspring and descendants, founding entirely new populations of humans. This scenario would result in significant changes to the human species, independent of natural selection. Genetic drift is a naturally occurring reduction in genetic diversity that is produced by Mendel's principle of randomness in the selection of alleles. Again, this is not caused by natural selection because fitness plays no role in the result. A special case of genetic drift is known as a population bottleneck. A population bottleneck is an alteration in the allele ratio produced by external causes, as in our example of ostracized colorblindness sufferers. Such a bottleneck can include things like migration, where a migrating population is some sample of the main population, wherein there is a different allele ratio than that found in the population as a whole. Population bottlenecks include any reduction of the genetic diversity of a population caused by external events. Take a disease that kills off one member of each family. Chances are that reduction left a different gene distribution in the overall population, thus producing a population bottleneck. This, too, can lead to a founder effect, a subpopulation with a different distribution of alleles than the original population that in turn produces generations of viable offspring. In other words, if the original population of Homo erectus that left Africa had a different allele ratio than the population that remained in Africa, the former and latter populations would be separate founder populations for the ensuing generations. Another form of evolutionary change is that affected by culture, a form known as the Baldwin effect, and particularly relevant to the evolution of human language. The Baldwin effect, first proposed in 1896 by psychologist James Mark Baldwin, was an important conceptual advance in evolutionary theory for at least two reasons. First, it underscored the importance of phenotypes, visible behaviors and physical characteristics, for natural selection. Second, it demonstrated the possible interaction of culture with natural selection. As a hypothetical example, let's suppose that a population of Homo erectus enters Siberia in the summer, only to discover later that Siberia is cold in the winter. Now assume that everyone learns how to make winter garments from bear fur, and that the most effective stitching of these furs requires manual dexterity that is extremely challenging or unavailable to the community as a whole, except for one lucky person who has a genetic mutation that allows him or her to bend their thumb to their forefinger in such a way as to produce a more effective, long-lasting stitch for bear fur coats. They therefore make more effective coats for their family. This in turn allows the members of their family to produce more offspring than the families of the stitch challenged. Eventually, the mutation will increase the chance that the original mutant's dexterity genetics will reproduce through their offspring, who, in turn, out-survive, in winter at least, the offspring of the less dexterous stitchers. Over time, the dexterity gene will spread throughout the population. The same genetic mutation in another environment would not have propagated throughout the population because it might not have provided any survival benefit. It would be in another environment simply a neutral mutation, of which there are many. This might happen if the coat-making phenotype is neutral in a warmer climate, such as Africa. We can say, therefore, that culture can turn neutral mutations into positive mutations. The Baldwin effect, also known as dual inheritance theory, brings culture and biology together and seeks to explain those evolutionary changes that can't be explained by either one on their own. Now, using our imagination once again, let's suppose that a woman is born during the time that humans are developing language. We will call this woman Ms. Syntax. While the rest of the community says things like, "You, friend," "He, friend," "She, not friend," Ms. Syntax says, "You, friend," and "He, friend," but "She, not friend." Or while everyone else is talking like, "Man hit me," "Man bad," Syntax lady might say, "The man who hit me bad." In other words, the syntax master has the ability to make complex sentences, while the rest of the population can only form simple sentences. Could the entry of complex sentences into human language have been a mutation, spreading via the Baldwin effect or some other mechanism, such as sexual selection? This is unlikely. Language presents a different case than genes for physical skills. The first reason for doubting that a mutation for syntax could spread through a population or be favored by the Baldwin effect is that it is unlikely that complex sentences would provide a survival advantage, especially in light of the fact that there are languages spoken today, as we discuss later on, that lack such complex syntax. These latter languages have survived in the same world as languages that do have complex syntax. Moreover, even if it were discovered that the languages currently claimed to lack complex syntax did show such syntax in some cases, this discovery would only underscore the fact that speakers of these languages survive fine in an environment 99% free of complex sentences. More importantly for Ms. Syntax, in order to be able to interpret complex sentences, one would need to be able to interpret complex syntax. Uttering complex sentences in a population that lacks the ability to do this where, in other words, you are the only person that is able to interpret or produce complex utterances, would be like yelling a warning to a deaf, mute, and blind person. One could argue that non-human primates can already do this, since they seem to be able to respond effectively to requests using complex syntax. The bonobo Kanzi comes to mind. But this is a far cry from actually being able to fully understand complex sentences. Following instructions given in recursive sentences, for example, might be a first step towards acquiring or evolving recursion, but only that. Ability to think in complex ways must precede talking in complex syntactic constructions, or no one would be able to fully understand those utterances. But how might such thinking arise? How could someone think in ways that they do not speak? One possibility is, perhaps, by planning events within events via images within images, or even, as many speakers in the world seem to do today, by thinking in larger stories that, although they use simple sentences, weave together complex thoughts. John fishes. Bill fishes. John catches fish. Bill stops. Bill eats John fish. Bill returns. John returns same time. This story, completely composed of non-complex sentences, says that John went to fish and later, or at the same time, depending on which is inferred by the context, Bill went to fish. John caught fish before Bill. So Bill stopped fishing and ate fish with John. Bill decided to stop fishing and return home. John returned home with him. There are, in fact, many languages in which simple sentences are woven together in complex stories just like this. Another example of complex thinking without complex sentences is intricate task performance or planning without talking at all, such as in weaving a basket with many parts. As the hypothetical fishing story has just shown, complex sentences are not required for complex thinking or storytelling. Complex thinking might make it possible to utter and interpret complex sentences, but it doesn't require them. The reverse, however, is not true. One must be able to compose complex meanings in order to interpret a complex sentence. On the other hand, it is possible that complex syntax would spread through a population by sexual selection. Members of the opposite sex might like to hear the melodic cadences of complex sentences, and so might mate more frequently with Ms. or Mr. Syntax, spreading the syntax genes. But this is unlikely. Complex sentences normally require words that indicate that they are complex. Those words, however, are largely unintelligible outside of the complex syntax they have arisen to signal. For example, John and Bill went to town in order to buy cheese is a complex sentence because of its clause within a clause, in order to buy cheese, but also because of its coordinate subject noun phrase, John and Bill. The word "and" is not understandable apart from being able to think in complex syntax. Complex sentences themselves also require complex gestures and pitch patterns that would need to have come about separately and that are unlikely to have arisen owing to a single genetic mutation. What seems more likely is that complex thinking was favored by natural selection and thus was a genuine Baldwin effect because it enabled complex planning. It might, and probably would have, shown up later in the form of complex sentences in some languages. In any case, the fascinating conclusion is that natural selection would quite possibly have treated a gene for syntax in language as a neutral mutation, not subject to natural selection. Recursion, which is a crucial aspect of human thinking and communication, certainly would have arisen early on in human cognition. This is the ability to think thoughts about thoughts, such as, Mary is thinking that I am thinking that the baby is going to cry. Or, Bill is going to get upset when he finds out that John believes that his wife is being unfaithful to him. Recursion is also seen in the ability to break tasks down into other tasks, such as, first build the spring, then place the small spring inside a lock, then place the lock inside another lock, and a spring within the larger lock. And it is visible in complex syntax in sentences. John said that Bill said that Peter said that Mary said that Irving said. It is not clear whether any non-human species is able to use recursive thought, nor whether Erectus or Neanderthalensis spoke recursively. But it would not have been necessary for them to have recursion to have language, at least according to the simple idea of language evolution as a sign progression and supported by some modern languages. It is not difficult to imagine a scenario in which complex or recursive thinking might arise. Suppose that someone is born with the ability to think recursively. This ability to think, not necessarily speak, recursively, would provide a cognitive advantage over other members of their community, enabling them to think more strategically, more quickly, and more effectively. They might become better hunters, better defenders of the community, or makers of complex tools. This indeed could help them to survive, and would in all probability make them more attractive than the competition to the opposite sex, leading to more mating and more offspring. It could also lead to children with the ability to think recursively, and soon this ability would spread throughout the population. At that point only would it be possible to speak recursively, and therefore for this new property to be incorporated into the grammar of the community. In other words, there could never be a gene for recursive syntax, because what is needed is a gene for recursive thinking across cognitive tasks. Recursion is a property of thought, not language per se. Thinking through the implications of these various sources of change in a species, it becomes clear that a single mutation in a particular behavior, such as language, would be unable to guarantee that all humans possess the same genetics that they had at the time the original change was introduced. The genotype could have been altered by the Baldwin effect, by genetic drift, or by a population bottleneck. Still, there is another force in evolutionary theory that can exercise a role in the spread and modification of languages over time. This is population genetics. Population genetics is concerned with the distribution and frequency of alleles within an entire population. How do groups adapt to their environment? How are new species formed? How are populations divided or structured? Population genetics is one of the most challenging areas of evolutionary theory because of the mathematical sophistication it requires for its application, controlling many variables in many individuals and many links between variables and individuals simultaneously. One of the pioneers in this field was a postdoctoral associate of Morgan, Theodosius Dobzhansky. Dobzhansky built a bridge between micro and macro evolution. Basing his studies on populations in their natural habitats, Dobzhansky showed that these populations, however similar they were phenotypically, manifested large degrees of genetic diversity below the surface. Though this genetic diversity is unseen, Dobzhansky demonstrated that it is always there and is crucial as particular subpopulations differ in their genetic makeup. This diversity renders each subpopulation subject to distinct phenotypic adaptations and speciation, given the right pressures and constraints on gene flow, frequency of mating between the subpopulations. Dobzhansky was but one of many researchers who examined crossbreeding and genetic drift in small populations, and how these could push populations away from one adaptive peak, a kind of local equilibrium in which the environment and the organism match well for a period of time. The basic ideas of population genetics turn out to be crucial to the understanding of change in individual languages and groups of languages over time. An overview of the various subfields of genetics and evolutionary change leads to the recognition that fossils are not the only pieces to the puzzle of human origins. The resources of molecular biology are also needed for a full picture. As the genomes of a variety of primates are sequenced, we can begin to estimate dates at which the different lineages of primates diverged evolutionarily. Therefore, because we know that humans and chimpanzees share 96% or so of their DNA sequences, closer than any other two primates, it then follows that there was a common ancestor of humans and chimps unshared by other great apes. Further work leads to the conclusion that this common ancestor split off from the other great apes about 7 million years ago. Humans are thus one of the newer apes. From this lineage, it is clear that all humans originated, as Darwin predicted, from Africa. So, we know quite a bit about early humans and the story of how life came to be on our planet. But how do we know this? More than DNA evidence is necessary. The reconstruction of the evolution of our species requires the sweat of hard fieldwork, finding, studying, and classifying fossils. Here, evolutionary theory takes on characteristics of an adventure novel. Who were these fossil hunters? What did they do for our understanding of human evolution? And how did competition and cooperation among them advance the science behind the evolution of human language? 2. The fossil hunters. What we do see depends mainly on what we look for. In the same field, the farmer will notice the crop, the geologist the fossils, botanists the flowers, artists the coloring, sportsmen the cover for the game. Though we may all look at the same things, it does not all follow that we should see them. John Lubbock. Though Darwin initially seemed wrong in his Africa First hypothesis, the first evidence that he might be right came from a German geologist, Hans Reck, shortly before the First World War. Not only was Reck the first European to behold the Olduvai Gorge in Africa's Great Rift Valley, his team was the first to recognize a hominin fossil there. As confirmation of Darwin's theory, and for paleontology more generally, the Great Rift Valley is vital and famous in the study of human evolution because of the fossil riches preserved by its unusual geological properties. The term originally described a 3,700-mile trench running from Lebanon to Mozambique, a fascinating geological formation that emerged from the splitting of the Earth's crust. However, most researchers today understand Great Rift Valley to refer to something smaller, to the part of East Africa where new tectonic plates are forming and literally beginning to tear the African continent apart. To find such a place anywhere on Earth is to find a time machine. Descending through the geological layers in the Rift Valley is like traveling back through history to prehistory, a journey of several million years. even though the interpretations of finds in the valley are often complicated by mixing and corruption of fossil sites by tectonic upheaval, flooding, volcanic activity, and so on, the Great Rift Valley has been, and continues to be, of inestimable importance for evolutionary theory. When he was there in 1913 to study the Earth's geological history and to excavate fossils, the 27-year-old Reck recognized this, and his work paid off. Near the end of 3 months of hard work in the formidable East African equatorial heat, a crouching skeleton was discovered in one of the oldest layers of the gorge. Reck recognized that the remains he had discovered were of a Pleistocene Homo sapiens who probably had drowned there some 150,000 years ago. The year was an ominous one, of course. Soon the War to End All Wars began, and paleoanthropological research was suspended in order to carry out the sinister work of mass killing. For that reason, not much else was to come from Olduvai until the arrival of Louis Leakey more than 20 years later. Leakey was a controversial researcher who energized paleoanthropology in much the same way that Chomsky did linguistics and Einstein physics, though Leakey did not lead as a theoretician. He shook up his field by grandiose claims that attracted publicity both to the field and to Leakey himself. Along the way, he and his family discovered some very important fossils in East Africa. Lewis also fostered research on primates in their natural habitat, recruiting and encouraging researchers such as Jane Goodall, chimpanzees, Diane Fossey, gorillas, and Biruti Galdikas, orangutans, to undertake their own field research. After both advancing the earlier research of Hans Reck and eventually working alongside Reck himself, Leakey and his team discovered artifacts such as Olduan and Acheulean tools, a skull of Paranthropus boisei, then called Zingianthropus, and Homo habilis, among many others. Leakey and the headline-making publicity he received attracted many scientists to paleoanthropology. Whatever his shortcomings, he earned his place as one of the innovators and founders of the field of paleoanthropology. More importantly, the findings of Leakey and other paleoanthropologists have provided incredible insights into the evolution of our species. We now know that the human skeleton evolved over the last 7 million years or so from the first likely hominins. Some of the features that distinguish us from other species include bipedalism, encephalization, reduction of sexual dimorphism, hidden estrus, greater vision and reduced sense of smell, smaller gut, loss of body hair, evolution of sweat glands, parabolic U-shaped dental arcade, development of a chin, styloid process, a slender piece of bone just behind the ear, and a descended larynx. These traits have become important to the classification and understanding of the place of different fossils in the hominin line. One of the adaptations of human skeleta to the world around them came as evolution provided a novel form of locomotion. Humans are the only primates that walk upright. Other primates favor crawling or tree swinging to get about. But to walk habitually, unlike a chimp, an orangutan, or a bear that can walk upright only occasionally and for brief periods, our skeleton needed to change from the basic primate model to support this upright posture. One example of its many changes is found in the hole at the bottom of our skulls, called the foramen magnum. This is the aperture through which our spines connect with our brains. When this is found at the back of the underside of the cranium, we know that the creature did not walk upright regularly, because it would have been extremely uncomfortable. The spine would emerge nearly parallel to the ground for a creature on all fours, but awkwardly incline the head if the creature walked upright. Another important milestone, the human head and brain, was achieved by a long process of encephalization, the gradual process by which our brain cases got larger. Hominin brain case volume increased from about 450 cubic centimeters for Australopithecines to sapiens 1250 cubic centimeters. The heads of hominins show larger and larger brain cases until the appearance at Homo sapiens. Neanderthalensis had even bigger brains than sapiens, averaging about 1400 cubic centimeters for males. Sapien skulls are large, rounded, and delicate compared to the smaller brain cases and thicker skulls of our hominin ancestors. Gone are the special ridges at the top of hominin skulls to anchor muscles for chewing, along with the heavy brow ridges that perhaps shaded our eyes from the sun. In their place came a larger brain, and our heads developed accordingly to give room and horsepower for thinking. Male and female bodies also grew more similar in size. That is, our sexual dimorphism was reduced. Although human males are roughly 15% larger than human females on average, this size difference is smaller than that of any other primate species. The reduction of sexual dimorphism in the primate line has social implications. When males and females become more similar in size, this correlates, among primates, with pair bonding or monogamy. Male primates spend more time helping females feed and raise children. This is particularly important for human primates, since our children require a longer time to mature. In some Western industrialized cultures, as much as one-third of a person's overall life expectancy is childhood, the length of time required to reach autonomous adulthood. If males and females bond for life, or simply in order to raise children, then the male will no longer need to battle other males for mating access. This reduces the pressure for males to have larger physical size, longer canines, and other features for fighting. Battle is no longer necessary in order to pass our genes along to the next generation. Along with bipedalism and reduced sexual dimorphism came a greater reliance on vision. Humans can see further than other primates and most other creatures, which enables them to run faster towards a visible goal. Moreover, beginning with the arrival of Homo erectus, humans acquired the capability of persistence hunting, running down game until it tires, and the hunter kills it with a stone axe or club, or until it dies of exhaustion and overheating. Persistence hunting is seen even today in societies such as the Xia communities, Mbengokra, Kunseje, Xirente, Xokleng, and others, in the savanna regions of the Brazilian Xingu River Basin. Evolution is also the ultimate economizer. With humans' greater dependence on vision came a loss of acuity and range in their sense of smell. If one portion of the brain gets bigger or better, another part very often grows smaller in the course of evolution. Here, the ability to smell degenerated as the vision region of human brains grew. Today, the portion of the brain available to vision is roughly 20%. Fortunately, if someone is born blind, the vision region can be enlisted for other functions. Evolution is often an efficient, no-waste process. Other changes to human physiology, not all with an immediately obvious intellectual benefit, might also have enhanced our species' intelligence. In the course of evolution, the length of the gut of hominins shrank. Intestines and digestive processes required fewer and fewer overall calories, enabling Homo bodies to shift more of their energy resources to their growing, ever-hungry brain with its expanding cranium. But natural selection does not receive all the credit for this change. Cultural innovation also played a role. Homo erectus learned to control fire as long as 1 million years ago. As pre-erectus hominins learned to eat cooked food, the fats and proteins that they then ingested were much easier for their digestive system to break down. Whereas until this time, hominins, like other primates, needed larger guts in order to break down the large amounts of cellulose in their diet. As hominins learned to cook, they were able to eat more meat, and consequently able to consume more energy-rich food and to reduce